Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for July 9th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, coping with an epidemic of HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe, how a bacterium helps its host fight off a parasite, and fireflies that synchronize in order to attract a mate. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how friendly baboons live longer, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The stunning thing about Eastern Europe is that there was virtually no HIV there until the mid-1990s.
Science contributing correspondent John Cohen reports in a package of news stories about the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Eastern Europe and what governments and non-governmental organizations are doing about it. It's part of a special section on HIV/AIDS in this week's Science.
And it really just took off like wildfire after then. And it took off because, most likely, of heroin.
What are the numbers? How fast is HIV spreading?
From 2001 until the last official UN AIDS estimate in 2007, it jumped 66%. It went up to 1.5 million.
And what, if anything, are health officials saying about this AIDS epidemic?
It's a huge region, and people have responded differently in different places, but more than 90% of the infections are in Russia and Ukraine. So I traveled to both Russia and Ukraine and looked at the responses to the epidemics there. It's surprising in Russia how little the government has addressed prevention efforts. They do have comprehensive treatment programs. And Ukraine, the government is more involved, but in both countries, they rely heavily on non-governmental organizations to drive the response.
You mentioned that what was driving the spread was the use of heroin. How are government officials and non-government organizations addressing that problem?
Well, outside of Eastern Europe, where they've had injecting drug use epidemics, countries have used what are called harm reduction techniques, like providing clean needles and syringes and opiate substitution drugs like methadone. With those harm reduction techniques put together into a package, they've almost completely stopped the spread of HIV in injecting drug users. Russia outlaws methadone altogether. It's not legal to use it. Ukraine only started to import methadone at the end of 2007, and there are only about 5,000 people right now receiving opiate substitution in Ukraine. Needles and syringe exchange in Russia also is spotty. It's done by non-governmental organizations, and Moscow City doesn't allow it. Ukraine is more progressive about that. But in both countries, the harm reduction efforts are spotty.
If these methods have worked in other countries, what, if any reason, do Russian officials and Ukraine officials, to the extent that they don't allow it, give for not using this method?
Well, interestingly, the officials in Russia would not respond to my many, many requests for interviews. And I've been to over 30 countries and met with government officials everywhere. I was really surprised by the reluctance of Russian officials to speak with me. But they have addressed these issues publicly again and again. And basically, they argue that what works in other countries isn't necessarily going to work in Russia. And they look at things like opiate substitution treatment as unproven and even dangerous, and they worry about people taking those substitute drugs and selling them on the black market. Many, many official public health bodies from UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the Institute of Medicine in the United States have endorsed opiate substitution treatment as a powerful way to slow the spread of HIV. There's no question in the international community's mind that it works, and there are abundant published studies showing the impact. So the reluctance of Russia to adopt these techniques has people just pulling out their hair.
So it's not as if HIV has changed itself, mutated in some way that makes...
No, it's not the behavior of the virus. It's the behavior of people and the behavior of officials. And Russia is promoting healthy lifestyle. as the main prevention technique. Now, some Russian NGO, non-governmental organizations, argue that they basically don't care about drug users and they don't care if they die. I mean, that's kind of a hard attitude, but you can see it when you're there that there really isn't much of anything progressive done by the government to help injecting drug users stay healthy.
These are obviously highly addictive substances, and there are new users all the time, I suppose. There's no end then, perhaps, in sight for this epidemic?
Well, drug use patterns in most every country follow the same cycle. When a new drug is introduced, there's a lot of abuse, and dependency with opiates occurs when new drugs are introduced. Heroin really was new to the region in the mid-1990s. So there's growing evidence that users are becoming older and older, which means that younger users aren't as attracted to heroin as they were 15 years ago. There also are homemade opiates in the region. In Ukraine, it's called Chernaya. It has different names everywhere. Those are made from poppy straw that is grown for seeds that are used in food and to make oil. So there's always been use of these homemade opiates, and that has continued. But that didn't really ignite the epidemic.
So there is then this idea that it will level off as these older drug users essentially die off.
Well, it's not going to go away. There are still people who are injecting and sharing equipment. And the question is, could you significantly reduce the number of new infections and also the spread from injecting drug users to other populations? I mean, there's a bridging that's occurring with injecting drug users and their sexual partners. And there's a round agreement that much more could be done to slow the spread. There's also a huge problem in the region with kids who live on the street. And those kids are really susceptible to HIV infection for a variety of reasons, including an incredibly high percentage of injecting drug users. And they inject various drugs, not just heroin. They inject ephedrine-based compounds, stimulants that you can buy at the pharmacy and cook up. And that's been a really overlooked problem.
You've mentioned a lot of frustration. Is there anyone that's hopeful?
Well, people are hopeful in the sense that treatment is now becoming widely available, and that's a huge improvement. And also prevention of mother-to-child transmission has improved greatly, which relies on anti-HIV drugs. So there is a great deal of hope about HIV-infected people living healthier, longer lives, but the real despair is in the prevention category. Is there hope? There's always hope everywhere I visit. And the hope in these countries has to do with how mercurial the political leadership can be. And as many people have pointed out, if a Russian leader or a Ukrainian leader says this is the way it should be, it doesn't matter what the science says. It will happen overnight. It doesn't matter what opposition exists. It will happen overnight. And so there are people who are hopeful that someone like Vladimir Putin will say, hey, let's have opiate substitution treatment, and then it will just happen.
But isn't there a history of political leaders in the Russian Federation taking these steps and spending money on HIV/AIDS?
After 2006, when the G8 summit was held in St. Petersburg, Putin and the Russian government made a much more serious financial commitment to addressing HIV/AIDS. But they have backpedaled, as I explain in the package, on a commitment to the non-governmental organizations to support their programs. So there's a lot of confusion right now about exactly what the Russian government is supporting. And there's also very little HIV/AIDS research in the region. The epidemiology that's done officially by the Russian and Ukrainian governments is really heavily criticized by outside epidemiologists because they simply rely on registered cases rather than doing the standard methodology of estimating by looking at high-risk groups and combining that with the registered cases. Other research, basic research and other types of behavioral research, it's really thin. There are islands of research, and I visited some that were doing excellent work, but for the capabilities of the region, it's surprising how little there is, and that's also linked to government support and organization. It just isn't there.
So the government then, with these epidemiological methods of actually counting registered cases rather than estimating, means that they would perceive the problem as less than it actually is.
Oh, it's clearly underestimated. And they're also ignoring certain risk groups like men who have sex with men for political and cultural reasons. They just don't look for it. And you don't find things you don't look for. I mean, that's the way it is everywhere. I think what a lot of people hope will happen is that these governments will learn from other countries. And you know, what has been shown to work again and again in other countries, they argue, will of course work in Russia and Ukraine and the rest of the region. Human beings are human beings. And the keys are targeting the high-risk groups and designing prevention programs that are specifically addressing the ways that they are transmitting the virus. That is the secret to success everywhere. And people want to see it happen in the region badly, and they're hoping that this international conference that's going to take place this month in Vienna, which should attract many researchers from the region, will finally put a spotlight on the issues in a way that leads to new actions that are more aggressive.
John Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Science contributing correspondent John Cohen reports on a package of news stories about the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Eastern Europe and what governments and non-governmental organizations are doing about it. It's part of a special section on HIV/AIDS in this week's Science that includes articles about gender inequalities in HIV prevention, universal access, HIV persistence, and the prospect of long-term drug-free remission for HIV-infected individuals. As the most widespread macroparasites of plants and animals, nematode worms cause all kinds of diseases, including river blindness in people, heartworm diseases in dogs and cats, and diseases that wither crops. In the 1980s, researchers found that a species of nematode had invaded a species of Drosophila, a fruit fly.
And virtually all of them, if they were parasitized, were completely sterilized by the nematodes.
John Janicki of the University of Rochester is lead author of a paper in this week's Science about how a species of bacteria living inside fruit flies has helped the fly adapt.
What we found in recent years is that a large fraction of these flies are no longer sterilized by nematode parasites, and that the cause of this is that the flies are infected with a bacterial species called Spiroplasma.
For diseases like river blindness, which affects many millions of people in dozens of countries, a black fly transmits the infecting nematodes to people through its bite.
So we're going to see, in the lab at least, whether or not Spiroplasma can be transmitted in black flies and whether it has an adverse effect on nematodes within black flies.
And that could reduce nematode transmission and so the incidence of the disease in people. But what the Spiroplasma bacteria is actually doing to the nematodes is still a mystery.
Although I can tell you by dissecting flies and looking at the nematodes, the nematode parasites inside these flies, if the flies carry Spiroplasma, the nematodes really are not doing well. They're a lot smaller. Sometimes they look very sick. They're shriveled. They're brown. They're not big and fat like the nematodes inside flies that do not carry Spiroplasma. So the Spiroplasma are definitely having some kind of adverse effect on the nematodes, but we don't know the mechanism of that yet.
Nevertheless, among the females that were parasitized by the nematodes, Janicki and his team showed that those flies also infected with the bacteria were 10 times more fertile than those who were not infected with the bacteria. That's allowing the Spiroplasma bacterial infection to spread quickly.
The Spiroplasma are transmitted from infected mothers to their offspring at a very high rate, and therefore, by restoring the fertility of infected parasitized female flies, the Spiroplasma are passed on to the next generation, and the flies themselves benefit because they have their fertility restored.
But it's not as if you can just take one species of bacteria and transplant it into a different host and expect it to do the same thing. Nancy Moran tried that with a bacterial species that she found helped aphids fight off parasitoid wasps.
What we found is we can move our symbionts between rather different aphid species much of the time, and sometimes they manage fine, and other times they just don't persist or they kill it. They kill the host because they just interact with the host genotype in a way that has a different outcome.
Moran is a researcher at Yale University and is not associated with the study.
In nature, it's clear that Spiroplasma jumps between distant species, but if you just take one strain out of a Drosophila and put it in, you know, something quite distinct, it may or may not work.
Instead, it may be yet another still undiscovered bacterial species to defend against the disease-causing nematodes. Again, study author John Janicki.
It turns out that the vast majority of insect species are actually infected with some kind of maternally transmitted bacteria. What's interesting is if the only way that these bacteria are transmitted among individuals is from mothers to offspring, then they have to confer some sort of beneficial effect, at least to the female or the cytoplasmic lineage. So I think there will probably be many cases where there will be beneficial mutualistic effects of these maternally transmitted bacteria. So I think if you went out and picked any random species and found the endosymbiont inside, it might be hard to find out what the function is, but I suspect it probably is serving some sort of a function.
But even as researchers find these functions, working with bacterial symbionts has its own challenges. Again, Nancy Moran of Yale University.
One problem with all of these systems is that it's very difficult to culture the symbionts. Difficult or impossible.
And that's because these bacteria need pretty much the exact conditions found only inside their hosts. And because of that,
it's hard to do manipulations on them in the way that one might be able to do with some other experimental systems in bacteria.
So what both Moran and Janicki say is needed to find symbionts that can defend against disease-causing nematodes is a detailed understanding of the host organism and its history, parasites, and natural enemies.
The only way someone can recognize one of these systems going on is if they really know the biology very well. So this group knows very well the biology of these insects, and they were able to use, you know, this detailed knowledge of natural history and how these nematodes work and how they're part of the life cycle and incorporate those into assays where they could really pull out this phenomenon. It's a very striking, it's not a subtle thing, it's a very strong defense. I mean, it's really, you know, a very striking phenotype in the flies, but they could only get at that by knowing quite a lot about these flies.
It's actually been a lot of fun. It's kind of mind-boggling to me, at least, seeing all these really strong interactions just below the surface of what you see out in nature.
You can read the paper, Adaptation via Symbiosis, Recent Spread of a Drosophila Defensive Symbiont, in this week's Science. People synchronize with one another all the time. Sometimes it's spontaneous, such as walking in step or clapping in an audience. Other times it's on purpose, like with dancing, or in sports, like synchronized swimming. But for certain species of fireflies, synchrony is critical to finding a mate. As Andrew Moisef and Jonathan Copeland report in a paper in this week's Science, synchrony is a kind of behavioral solution to a physiological problem. The physiological problem? How does a female firefly recognize a potential mate of the same species with the males all flying around and flashing about in the dark? I spoke with Moisef from his office at the University of Connecticut.
A lot of people have seen fireflies, and usually you see them in your backyard just flashing all over the place. In certain places, the fireflies all flash together synchronously. It's an absolutely remarkable display. And what we were interested in doing was trying to understand the behavioral importance of why fireflies would flash together instead of all be out flashing independently of one another.
And only males flash?
Males and females flash. It's actually a communication dialogue. In the typical firefly, the males are flying, and we call them patrolling, basically flashing, looking for females to respond to those flashes. Females in our species are stationary. They're on the ground, on leaves or something, and they will respond to the appropriate flashes with their own flash pattern. And basically that establishes a dialogue where the male can find the female, he flies down to her, and that's the prelude to courtship and mating.
And how did you and your co-author, Jonathan Copeland, test for this behavioral response to synchronous flashes?
What we did in order to study synchrony is we basically decided to build an artificial field, if you want to call it that. We used light-emitting diodes, each one representing, let's call it a virtual male. The diodes were programmed to produce a male-like flash of the appropriate species, and then our computer was able to have those light-emitting diodes either flash all simultaneously to mimic synchrony or various levels of asynchrony, so that you'd have each light-emitting diode still acting as a male, so producing the correct male pattern, but in some cases, all of the diodes were simultaneously producing the pattern. In other cases, they were doing it at their own particular point in time.
So when all of your virtual males were flashing synchronously, the females responded?
When all of the virtual males flashed synchronously, the female responded extremely well. So what would happen is it wasn't testing numbers of females, but how each female individually would respond. A female would respond to about 82% of the displays, which is a high number. In contrast, when the males were still producing the correct pattern, but the light-emitting diodes were asynchronous, it went down as low as 3% of the time the female would respond. So we have this very clear demonstration that females respond more effectively when it's synchronous versus when it's not synchronous.
And how much time did the flashes have to be asynchronous or not in unison before the females lost interest?
Well, there are two levels to that. There's a very, very slight decrease if the lack of synchrony is on the order of tens of milliseconds. But that's not statistically different, so we won't count that. In contrast, if you have asynchrony on the order of hundreds of milliseconds to seconds, then you find that the females, as you say, would lose interest. To explain that a little bit better, you need to understand what the flash pattern is to help it understand what the asynchrony is. In the species we studied, we have approximately six flashes. Basically, those flashes are occurring twice per second, so blink, 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 followed by about 6 to 8 seconds of no flashing at all. So you have a train of flashes and then a dark period. So what you found is as you are asynchronous, you start to lose that identifiable dark period because some of those virtual males are flashing when under normal conditions it would be dark. So your basic flash cycle is approximately 10 seconds, the six flashes followed by the dark period. So that's the cycle. Within that 10-second repeating cycle, if you start to desynchronize the light-emitting diodes by hundreds of milliseconds to seconds, then you start to decrease the female's responsiveness.
So over time, they fall more and more out of sync.
Well, the way we do it for the experiment is we set the degree of synchrony at the beginning of the experiment. So what you would have is some degree of desynchrony, and you maintain that degree the whole time. That's the advantage of being able to do this under computer control, because we can fully define the degree of synchrony or the degree of asynchrony.
I see. So every 10 seconds, every cycle, there's a refresh, a start over, so that you're only a few milliseconds off.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, what do you and your co-author suppose is going on physiologically that the synchronous flashing by males is a solution, a behavioral solution?
When you look at the female firefly, not the males that are synchronous, but the female fireflies, the female firefly has to see this visual signal. So we were interested in how the eye, the visual system, and the brain sees the male flashes and then does the important neural processing, which is to recognize those flashes as being a conspecific and then triggering the appropriate female behavior, which is to respond to the males. So each of our light-emitting diodes by itself is an appropriate conspecific signal to which by itself the female would respond to. Imagine now a whole bunch of light-emitting diodes, each one of which has exactly the right pattern. If the female could attend to any single LED, then she should respond to that LED. But we find when we have simultaneous light-emitting diodes, each one with the appropriate pattern, but they're asynchronous, she no longer behaviorally responds to that pattern, which our interpretation was that she can't recognize it, that all of those other flashes are becoming clutter, jamming, somehow interfering with her ability to process it. So the physiology suggested that the female is looking at a large visual field, looking at all the flashes in that visual field, and taking that information to see if the pattern that she's looking for is present.
How do the males get in sync with one another?
Excellent question. What we know, first of all, it requires visual communication. The males are seeing each other's flash. We've done, again, equivalent sort of experiments where we've taken a male, put it with a light-emitting diode that represents another male, and the male will synchronize to that light-emitting diode. The exact mechanism is not totally known, but the standard theories are that the oscillators, or whatever the circuitry is that generates the rhythm for flashing, can either advance or slow down in order to get two males in synchrony.
So with all of the males flashing together, there's no advantage of this flashing to a particular male of the species.
We see it as exactly that, with the exception that there may be a disadvantage to not being synchronous. And the thought is, this still has to be proven, but the thought is, if you're not synchronous, you may in fact decrease the female's probability of responding to anybody, which will decrease the ability to find her. So whether it's a cooperative behavior, the males in a sense cooperate so that females respond, or some other behavior, that's something which we still have to get better understanding of.
Andy Moiseff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Andy Moiseff of the University of Connecticut is co-author, along with Jonathan Copeland at Georgia Southern University, of a paper on why fireflies synchronize. Finally today, David Graham, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how friendly baboons live longer. Dave, does this kind of research have any implications for human friendships and longevity?
Well, Rob, actually, we already know that humans live longer when they form strong social bonds. Studies have shown that humans that tend to have more friends and stronger relationships with those friends tend to live longer. So we already know this happens in humans. The question with this study is, does it happen in other animals? And the reason we want to know that is because if humans and other animals, especially close relatives like baboons, have behaviors in common, it suggests that these behaviors have a strong evolutionary component.
So that it evolved in multiple species, or our ancestors in common with baboons and other mammals?
Exactly. The idea is that something like this, like friendship, may have evolved a long time ago, even before humans came on the scene. It may have been something that was present in a common ancestor between us and other primates. And why that's important is, if something's been around for that long, and we're talking millions of years, then it must be important in some way. Researchers have speculated that friendship may do everything from help us reduce stress to actually helping our wounds heal faster. So you could see that if friendship is important beyond humans, that it really means that it's been a very important behavior, not only to our species, but to other species for a long, long time.
So what did this research focus on?
Well, they're looking at baboons here, and they're specifically looking at 44 female baboons. Now, researchers have tried to look at friendship in other animals before, but the problem with studying animals, and especially studying something like friendship, I mean, this is not something that you can say, you know, hey, does that monkey like bananas, or does that monkey like, you know, nuts? It's not something that you can just observe for a couple hours and see the difference. Something like friendship, you really have to observe for a very long time. And in fact, in this study, they followed the baboons from 2001 to 2007. So they were looking at them for a really long time. This is something that hasn't been done with other animals before. And they looked at 44 female baboons, and over the years, they cataloged which females tended to hang out more with other females, how long they tended to hang out with other females. And the whole idea was to try to get a sense of who everyone's friends were and how strong the relationship was between those friends.
Why only females?
Well, it turns out among baboons, females are the only gender that tends to form strong social bonds. The males tend to be off doing other things and tend to be more competitive with each other than cooperative. So if you want to study friendship, it's really best, at least in this species, to look at the females.
And what did this friendship or these strong cooperative bonds consist of exactly?
Well, the researchers were looking at things like how frequently one female would approach another female, how long they groomed each other, and other things like that.
And the effect of this kind of friendship?
Well, the researchers found that just like in humans, the female baboons that form the strongest social bonds were also the ones that live the longest. The ones that formed weak social bonds tended to live anywhere from about 7 to 18 years. Those that formed strong social bonds lived anywhere from 10 years and up. And they say and up because they were still, a lot of these baboons were still alive by the time the study ended. So they really don't know what the upper limit is for a lot of these very social baboons.
And these baboons were in the wild, but protected so that they're not being hunted, or what?
Right. When these baboons are dying, they're typically dying of natural causes because they're on a game reserve, which means they're being protected.
So the lower limit was 7 years for those who didn't have these strong social bonds and 10 years for those who did have these strong social bonds. That's quite an increase.
It is quite an increase. And baboons can live more than 25 years. So again, this most social group, we don't know how long they're going to live, but what the researchers are assuming based on these numbers is that they're already living longer than their less social group members. And the researchers are saying, based on these numbers, that overall it's going to be a really significant amount longer that these most social female baboons are living.
And were these baboons the ones that are living the longest? Are they the ones with the oldest friendships?
Exactly. It was the ones with the strongest, the most stable, and the longest lasting relationships that lived longer than the other baboons.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from baboons to a much larger animal, the woolly mammoth. This next story is about whether the extinction of woolly mammoths led to a warming of the earth.
How would that happen?
Well, it turns out mammoths are a lot like elephants. They are pretty harsh on vegetation. They strip leaves. They eat a lot of grass. They tend to practically deforest a lot of the regions that they spend a lot of time in. And researchers know that a lot of vegetation is really important for the temperature of an area, especially some leaves, especially if they're darker leaves. Darker leaves absorb more heat, so the more leaves you have, the hotter things get. And so you would imagine that if a bunch of mammoths were in an area and they were stripping all these dark leaves away, and then all of a sudden the mammoths disappeared and all these leaves came back again, all of a sudden the temperature is going to go up.
And what's the evidence that this actually happened?
Well, researchers focus on an area that's called Beringia, which is this land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. Now, we don't see that land bridge anymore because it's underwater, but it used to be above water. And this is where a lot of mammoths spent their time tens of thousands of years ago. But about 15,000 years ago, their population plummeted. They all started to die off. And it was also around this time that researchers noticed a temperature increase. But they didn't know if they were related at all. And in fact, there's been a lot of theories about why the mammoths died in the first place. Did human hunters hunt them to extinction? Was there climate change before the mammoths started dying off, and that's what caused the mammoths to start dying off because they couldn't deal with the heat? This study doesn't really answer that question, but it tackles the question of what impact did the mammoth die-off have on the environment? So almost the flip side of that question. And so what researchers did was they looked at fossil records in Beringia. They looked at a lot of the fossil pollen records to see what was going on with the plants at the time.
Getting sediments off the seafloor.
Exactly. And they looked at mammoth fossil records to figure out when mammoth populations started to decline. They even looked at elephant feeding habits to try to get a good sense of how many trees these mammoths were eating. And one of the big trees in this area was a genus of birch tree called the betula. And this is a tree with dark leaves. And as we said earlier, you know, those leaves are really absorbing a lot of sunlight. And what the researchers found was when they combined all this data together, plugged it into some climate models, they found that the die-off of these mammoths caused an explosion in these trees. These trees, these betula trees, became much more abundant than they were before. And when that happened, the researchers also saw about a 0.2 degrees Celsius increase in the temperature of this area and a 0.1 degrees Celsius increase in the average warming of the entire world. And they all trace it back to the die-off of these mammoths.
Climate modeling is pretty complicated, though, right? So what are other researchers saying about this?
Well, other researchers are saying this is a very controversial question. And one outside expert for this story says that there's evidence that actually the birch trees started coming back a long time before the mammoths actually went extinct. But what she says is interesting about this paper is that it really looks, again, at the opposite side of this equation, not what caused the extinction of the mammoths, but what did the extinction of the mammoths cause? And this is a question that researchers really haven't spent a lot of time looking at until now.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from looking under the Bering Sea to looking under the surface of the moon, this last story is about what exactly is in the moon's interior.
How would you go about measuring something like that?
Well, as you can imagine, we can't just send a drilling rig over to the moon and start drilling below the surface and figuring that out. The closest we've really come is that Apollo astronauts have brought back a lot of rocks from the moon, and that tells us what's on the surface of the moon and tells us a lot about the mineral content of the surface, but it doesn't tell us anything about what minerals are under the surface or in the mantle of the moon, which is below the lunar crust.
Why are researchers interested in finding out what's under the surface of the moon?
Well, Rob, there's a hypothesis that a huge celestial object slammed into Earth about 4.5 billion years ago, and it dislodged so much material from our planet that that material actually coalesced and became our moon. It's a hard theory to prove, though. One way to support that would be to show that the composition of the moon is similar to the composition of the Earth. And we know that the mantle of the Earth is heavy in a mineral called olivine. And so the question would be, if the moon's mantle is also heavy in olivine, that would be good confirmation that both of these bodies came from the same place.
So some other source of data then besides what the Apollo astronauts brought back.
Exactly. And so what researchers did in this study was a Japanese team that used data from the lunar orbiter called Kaguya. And this orbiter scanned the surface of the moon between 2007 and 2009 and looked for traces of olivine. And it actually scanned 70 million points on the moon. And it found a signature of olivine reflectance at about 245 of those points. So a very, very tiny fraction. But what was interesting about this fraction is when they mapped out where the orbiter had seen the olivine mapped very well to the edges of major craters on the moon's surface.
So caused by impacts into the moon's surface, which would bring out what's underneath the surface.
Exactly. That's what they're speculating. You know, if we can't get underneath the moon's surface ourselves, asteroids and comets do a pretty good job of that because they slam into the moon with such force that they're actually dislodging material from the moon's mantle. And theoretically, you would be able to see that in these really deep impact craters. And that's what the researchers say they're seeing here.
So we know maybe a little bit better about what is under the surface of the moon. Does that help solidify the hypothesis about how the moon formed?
Well, if the olivine really did come from the mantle, then it really does provide evidence for this theory that the moon came from an impact with Earth, because the moon's mantle would be very similar to Earth's mantle. But some scientists say we can't actually be sure that this olivine came from the mantle. It's possible it just came from the crust of the moon, and we don't really know exactly what's going on with these asteroids and comets or hitting the lunar surface, exactly where this material is that they're dredging up.
The idea being that the asteroids or comets themselves could have this olivine in them.
Well, that's possible. Or it's possible that these impacts weren't actually strong enough to dislodge material from the mantle, and therefore what researchers are seeing is just olivine that's come from the crust.
So it's still sort of an open question about this original hypothesis about whether some rather large object struck Earth and eventually coalesced into the moon.
Well, you know, this is a pretty well agreed upon hypothesis, but, you know, you always want evidence to support it. And this evidence has not been easy to come by. But now they're starting to get something that seems like it's making this hypothesis a much more solid story.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the incredibly shrinking proton. It turns out that protons may actually be smaller than researchers had thought. And also a story about how changing the housing of mice might shrink their tumors. And we've also got coverage from ESOF. This is the European Open Science Forum, sort of Europe's answer to the AAAS meeting that we hold every year. There's a lot of interesting science happening there that's being held in Turin, Italy. Stories about green motorcycles, and not green the color, but environmentally friendly. And also how Italian scientists are selling their research with fine Italian dining. And finally, on Science Insider, we continue our oil spill coverage. And we've also got a story about ClimateGate. This was this release of emails that took place between prominent climate scientists a while back, and there's been an investigation of exactly what happened and what it means for climate scientists in general. And we've got reporting on that investigation, and you can check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the July 9th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.